Hello and welcome to Microbrew, Milwaukee Brewers chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The Milwaukee Brewers won every single game this week, 6-0, a tremendous week of baseball. They win three games against the Philadelphia Phillies in Philadelphia. They were the best team in the National League coming into the week, and the Brewers beat them all three times on the road. Prior to that, they swept a three-game series against the Boston Red Sox, couple walk-off wins in there, back-to-back, a truly special week of baseball, and we got to break it all down. Here's Todd Rosiak. He is my colleague at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, and Todd? We haven't had a week like this in a long time. I mean, they've won every Sunday game for the last 7 weeks, so it's always been like, well, at least they won on Sunday, but it was a rough week. This week, I don't think there's anything we can really even. I guess the defense by both Boston and Philadelphia was suspect enough that you could say, well, they kind of got a couple gifts in there. But as always, when a team does this well, the question is. Is it real? Is this a quarter turned, or is it just one hot week of baseball? How do you look at it, Todd, having seen the Brewers tear it up this week?
I will note, first of all, that I started the winning streak in Pittsburgh last Sunday, so I think I deserve a little credit.
It also, is all on you. Everything's on you.
Saturday in Philadelphia, the Brewers also notched their first Saturday victory of the season. I believe they were 0-9 on Saturdays coming into this
really?
Weekend, which is kind of a weird statistic. Yeah. But I think this is just an example of a team that is finally kind of discovered itself, I guess, if that makes sense. The stars are starting to play like stars. The lesser players, or the role players, or the regulars, however you want to say it, are carrying their weight. The pitching has been good. Defense has tightened up. The base running has been good. So this is looking much more like the Brewers of 2024. I mean, obviously, there's still a long way to go. But, you know, 7 days ago, 8 days ago, I had written that story about, oh, who are the Brewers going to trade? You know, it's crazy how fast the narrative can change. And that's not to say that, you know, that still can't happen. There's, like I said, there's still a long way to go. But a lot of things to like. You know, Pat Murphy talked about rediscovering that misplaced edge, and it seems like the Brewers have done that. So good on them. And I'm heading to Cincinnati early Monday morning, and we'll see if I can continue the winning streak. I'm guessing not, because I have not had good luck this year.
You have played the role of Kurt Hoge this year. Kurt famously over the last couple of years, famously to us, could not see any victories when he went on road trips. But this year, it's been transferred.
Yeah, for sure. And it's just funny how baseball works that way. Last year, I kind of had the golden touch. And, you know, we say that tongue in cheek, because obviously we have nothing to do with what happens on the field. But it makes a difference when you are, you know, traveling with the team and guys are in a better mood, and you're there's just a better vibe around the team. You're getting better quotes. You're writing better stories as a result of it. And people are just more excited than, you know, covering a series where a team gets swept and, you know, there's just nothing good that comes out of it and somebody gets hurt. And it just makes for a happier circumstance all the way around.
Sunday was shaping up like a little bit of a vibe killer, because Christian Yelich left that game early. He got hit by a pitch, you know, talking about guys getting healthy. That's been a big part of this, is that they've started to see really their health round into shape. But then Christian Yelich took a pitch off of his hand. He stayed in the game briefly to run the bases, but then he was removed for his next at bat in the third inning. Sounds like after the game, our colleague Kurt Hoge was there. Sounds like, you know, x-rays are negative, so he doesn't have a broken bone, but he is going to probably miss a few games, it sounds like, or a couple games anyway. So that was a bummer. Then Jose Quintana promptly took a screamer off of his leg. And it wasn't, you know, immediately clear that he would stay in the game, but he did. Ended up fighting through his first start back from his own injury, his own rehab appearances. And then the Brewers ended up rallying to win that game. Now, again, Philadelphia's defense played a lot into it. I do think, Todd, they played these teams at the right time. Boston had a really bad series, punctuated by Christian Campbell's throw from second base to home. Generously, I think it was in the direction of home, but it was really just, it was about 10 feet wide that allowed the Brewers to end up winning that game in walk-off fashion. There was a huge misplay by Trey Turner at shortstop for Philadelphia today after a fly ball that should have been caught by Weston Wilson allowed Caleb Durbin to get to second. So I am cautiously optimistic. People who listen to this will know that I'm never going to go all in on the positive side. It does feel like, maybe getting Philly off of a doubleheader, that helped. I don't know, because the starting pitching was the guys they got to, so I don't know if that really played into it.
No Bryce Harper.
He was hurt and still working his way back. So I don't know if I like fully buy into it, but what you saw on Saturday, the 17 runs, you know, just pounding the baseball. I mean, Jesus Luzardo is like one of the best pitchers in baseball this year, and they made him look like a batting practice pitcher. That's something we haven't seen this year. And I keep thinking, and I've said this, I think there has to be a roster move to bolster this offense. And then you come through this week and think, now who's it going to be? I mean, Caleb Durbin was the obvious guy, and he's hitting the ball really well, or at least better than he was for sure. So going forward, do you think that's been canceled, at least temporarily, that they need to reinforce this roster? Or is that still something the Brewers should absolutely be in the market to do?
I'm sure that they're always listening, always, monitoring what's going on the market. But I think that they were pretty well set on working with what they had for the time being. And now that what they have is doing really well, they're going to be even less motivated to go out and make a move. So you mentioned Caleb Durbin. He's really shown it in the last week. You know, this is starting – he's starting to look like the player that the Brewers thought they were getting when they made that trade. And, you know, he's a rookie. You know, this is his first go-round through the big leagues, and there's going to be ups and downs, and there were some protracted downs. But starting with that game in Pittsburgh last Sunday, he's really shown something. And while the pop hasn't been there, the slug hasn't necessarily been there, the guy's hitting eighth, ninth in the order. He's driving in a lot of runs. You know, he's had some timely hits. He's stealing bases, and he's played what I would say, I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but definitely an above average third base defensively. So I don't think you can really quibble with anything that he's done at that position. And then, you know, Joey Ortiz, the slug still is not there, but he's showing signs. You know, he's showing signs. He's had some bad luck, I think. He's hit some balls hard, but right at guys. I think that, you know, over the course of time, if he stays the course, he'll be okay. Are his numbers going to be pretty at the end? Probably not. But, you know, if you can get a little bit more consistent offense out of him, the defense has been better as well. So I feel better overall about what the left side of the infield is producing of late, for sure.
If Christian Yelich needs an injured list stint, and again, right now it doesn't sound like he will, that stinks because he was just turning the corner. I mean, he obviously had multiple multi-home run games in recent, over the past 10 days. He had one in Pittsburgh and then again in Philadelphia. But also, it does strike me that there isn't an obvious person to bring up. Like, they already aren't really using Daz Cameron all that much. We actually saw more of him in Philadelphia than we had seen. You know, Eric Casas, the backup catcher, took Yelich's place briefly. Jake Bowers has barely played, and Jake Bowers has been performing well. So I don't know what the move would be to like supplement the offense with somebody who could maybe DH, I guess, or they just, you know, they add somewhere else on the diamond. I don't know. What have you seen from Christian Yelich? Because we've talked about recently how he has struggled so badly that it is his worst season, quite honestly. And now that has course corrected a little bit with the way that he has played lately. How big of a deal would it be in your mind if he ends up being hurt enough that he has to miss several games here?
Yeah, I think that would be huge, a huge blow. It sounds, just listening, I just watched a video that Kurt had posted from the clubhouse in Philadelphia. And Yelich said that he came out just because he was having a hard time gripping the bat and his hand was swelled up. You know, if it's a game or two absence, not a big deal, really. To put him on the IL, obviously, it would have to be a much more serious injury and it would be a larger blow. To me, obviously, Christian Yelich is swinging the bat as well as he has all season. You don't want to stem that tide. You don't want to break that momentum. You want to keep him going and see if he can continue to get hot. I mean, what has he he's raised his batting average, what, 35, 40 points in the last 8-9 days or something like that. So,
yeah.
You know, he's on pace for 100 RBI season, which is crazy to say. It's crazy to think about, but you know, he is showing that he can be a consistent run producer. So it's just always seemed like in the past, right when he gets going, something happens to kind of knock him back and he winds up on the IL or missing a stretch of games. Hopefully for him and the Brewers, that's not the case this time.
Yeah, that is the truth. It does feel like it lines up with him really hitting the ball well. Of course, his first walk-off home run of his career, and it's a grand slam against Boston on Tuesday night. What a thrill ride that was. Incredible ending to that game. That was a fun one. The Brewers did make a roster maneuver here, and that is one that they made on Sunday, and that's to designate Tyler Alexander for assignment. He worked in that lopsided win Saturday, gave up a whole bunch of runs in the ninth. The game was well in hand. I mean, it scored 17 runs, so that was fine. But just, you know, his ERA now up over 6. His FIP is quite a bit better than that. I think he did get a little bit unlucky. But I also just think the Brewers had enough guys now where it was time to, you know, time to move on. Jose Quintana needed to be added to the roster off of his injury, you know, off his injury rehab. But more than that, I do feel like, you know, in designating Pyamps more recently, although Yoel Pyamps, I think, is back with the organization, I believe. I'm actually not sure if that's where we stand with that, but he cleared waivers. And then Alexander, I just think they just couldn't afford that anymore. You had to be producing to stay on the roster. And even though those are painful roster decisions to designate guys for assignment and, you know, possibly, probably lose them altogether, it just felt like it was time. I thought, Todd, they might do something a little crazier and send down Chad Patrick just because he has options to just try to preserve that depth for as long as humanly possible. Patrick then had such a good outing on Saturday. I just didn't think that, you know, and if Brandon Woodruff isn't available to come back this week for whatever reason, they would have been short a starter if they had done that. But the move for Alexander, did that surprise you? Did you feel like it was just time? We reached two-month mark. It's time, you know, to really keep all the guys that are producing. How would you assess it?
Yeah, I mean, really, it was time. It wasn't a surprise to me in the least. This is, you know, when they signed him, they definitely had a need in spring training. And this was a guy that had experience and had excelled as a swingman. Had started games, had done long relief. And early in the season, he was very good at that. But in recent outings, not so much. I'm just going back here. 1, 2, 3, 4. 6 of his last 7 outings, he allowed a run. Two of those multiple, you know, kind of blow up innings, and there really was not a need for him anymore. They've got Ashby back, they've got Hall back, so they've got length covered in the bullpen. And both of those guys are lefties as well. So if the guy's not pitching well, there's really no point in keeping him around. You don't have to feel too bad for him. He signed a guaranteed deal, so he walks away. You know, he gets $750 for the year, and you know, who knows? There's always life out there, it seems like, for lefties and opportunities. Maybe he latches on somewhere else. He was a good guy by all accounts, but you know, this is a results oriented game, and the Brewers have shown time and time again that they don't shy away from making tough decisions or decisions that, you know, may be unpopular. Although I'm not saying that this one would be necessarily so. Just part of the business. He wasn't performing, and they needed a roster spot, so time to move on.
I think the one quibble I would say is that was the one guy they signed. That was the one guy they signed this offseason. They made so few maneuvers in free agency. They bring in Tyler Alexander and he only lasts 2 months. That is real tough. But
Alvin Rodriguez, too, that one hasn't really panned out either.
Nope, you're absolutely right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's real rough. But it's okay. They've got the bodies. They've got people. I mean, at this point, you look at this roster and the rotation. I mean, Jacob Isorowski is still there at AAA. I still think he gets called up soon. He did have a rough outing this week, but he's, you know, lightning waiting to be brought up to the major league roster. Logan Henderson, who got sent down after 4 incredible outings. You know, we didn't even talk about that on last week's episode, because I think that transaction happened on Monday. All he's done is produced, and they had to send him down because they felt they had to send him down because he had options and they could afford to get away with it. You've got Craig Yoho, who has been a very effective reliever. He actually had a rough outing this week too, but he's been very effective at AAA. Like, he's a big league level reliever, and they haven't needed those guys because they also have Quintana and Chad Patrick performing, and Aaron Civale is healthy and back, and DL Hall, like you said, can give you length. He worked 3 innings on Saturday. Brandon Woodruff, I guess, is coming back sometime soon. I guess I don't know what happens with Brandon Woodruff. Now you've got 5 guys. If the Quinn Priester DL Hall thing is one of those two is a starter still, you got 5 guys in the rotation, and they can afford to be really patient with Woodruff. As you look at the Woodruff situation, I believe he's got one more rehab outing coming. And then he would theoretically be back a week from, like, roughly a week from now, or like June 9th or something along those lines. Do you still see that as a timeline? I mean, I told Kurt, I was getting a little nervous about this timeline with the way that his velocity is still where it is. It's just making me wonder if and when he's going to pitch this year.
Yeah. The velo thing, I wouldn't get too worked up about. Anytime we bring that up with Pat Murphy, he always kind of rolls his eyes and reaffirms to us that when these guys are pitching in the minor leagues on rehab assignments, they're focusing on different things. And by and large, just the juice is not there. Pitching in front of small crowds in a minor league ballpark, it's just not the same animal. And it wouldn't be surprising at all to see Brandon Woodruff, whenever that first start comes with the Brewers, you know, his first few pitches ramping up, and you're like, oh wow, we didn't expect that. Well, that just comes with the extra adrenaline, assuming that he's, you know, going to make his first start at home in front of the home fans. They're going to be all excited. So I don't read too much into that. It's just been a real kind of stop start, extended rehab assignment for him. And I had predicted like early May, mid May myself. And it looked like he was kind of on that timeline. And then the ankle thing popped up, and now it's just been almost kind of head scratching in a way. They're also juggling spots on the 26 man roster. You know, there are those mm-hmm. accommodations that need to be made too. So there's moving pieces. It's more than just Brandon Woodruff. I think they're, you know, they want him to be comfortable. They want him to be, as rested as possible and ready to go. They want to be in a good spot with their bullpen and everything. And I think also if everything lines up accordingly, they would also like to have him make that first start at home for a number of reasons. So if it winds up being this next homestand, that's definitely going to be something to watch out for. And whoa, Nelly, if they decide to all of a sudden call up Mizorowski too, maybe that would happen on the homestand. That would be quite something as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for it, but now it starts to feel like there has to be an injury for that to happen. They're working, and Logan Henderson worked on Sunday in a very short stint. Mizorowski has worked in short stints. I don't get the sense that they are trying to preserve bullets, is my thought here. I'm thinking these guys are going to be here soon, but it is, there has to be an opening. There has to be a spot for them. And unless Quinn Priester moves to the bullpen full time, they don't seem to want to do that necessarily. And Priester pitched very well this week. I don't even know. I don't know where there's one, let alone two. I made a prediction, Todd, at the beginning of the season that Rhys Hoskins would be an all-star. And I'm pretty proud of it because right now he is hitting the ball so well. He hit two home runs in Philadelphia, his old stomping grounds, in that whooping on Saturday. Excellent by everyone on the offense, but Hoskins, of course, pitched in big time. There's a couple pretty good first basemen in the National League. And so he'd have to be sort of the third, I think, first baseman on the NL All-Star team. But I'm feeling so good about it. You think it's just health? Is that all? Is that all it is? Is there any bigger explanation beyond that other than, hey, Rhys Hoskins finally has a full year removed from that ACL injury, and now he's just back to being his old self because this is as good as he's been. This is a best case, not as good as he's been, but a best case scenario for what the Brewers could expect out of him.
Yeah, I mean, having never had a bad knee injury, knock on wood, I certainly would never know what it's like to come back from one of those. But that's what we've heard from the start of spring training on is, you know, he finally feels like he's got that true base underneath him, that leg strength, that drive. And anybody that knows baseball knows that, you know, hitting, pitching, so much of that is derived from the lower body. And when you have that solid base, it makes all the difference in the world. So I think it's a combination of that. I think it's a combination of confidence, comfort, and let's be honest too. He's going to be in a contract year as well. So you obviously from your perspective, if you're Rhys Hoskins, you want to put up some good numbers to try to get another contract moving on. So all things considered, great news for him, great news for the Brewers, and just really good guy. You know, happy for him that he's been able to come back and to do what he's done in Philly. In this last series, that's got to be tremendously gratifying. I remember last year, you know, he hits that home run off Zach Wheeler. He's cheered, then booed, then cheered, and it was kind of the same thing again on Saturday with the two homers, six RBIs as well.
Yeah, some loud cracks of the bat as Kurt Hoag, our colleague again, who's there, tells it. You know, the loudest sounds were Rhys Hoskins, the ball hitting his bat, and then the boos that rained down as he had a six RBI game. I mean, Jake Bowers has been really good, too. First base is the best position on the diamond for the Milwaukee Brewers, Todd. The last time we could say that, I'm fairly certain, was the Prince Fielder era. And heck, with Braun, maybe you can't even say that then. I don't know. But this has been a really interesting year for first base, guys. Bauer's more in a reserve role, and it's not like his numbers are overwhelming, but they are they're solid for what you're getting out of him. On the downside, I wanted to touch real quickly on the outing by Freddy Peralta earlier this week. It was on a Wednesday. The Brewers ended up, obviously, they won the game. They won all the games this week, but he really, really labored. He threw a lot of pitches. He ended up going over 100, but that was just to get through the fifth inning, which actually was ultimately, I think, a pretty good inning for him, the fifth inning, and help them win that game. But you know, that's a couple outings in a row. And, you know, I've gone back and kind of thought about last year a little bit and listened to some of our old podcasts over the last couple of weeks. And we're saying the same thing about him then too. I think this is just who Freddy Peralta is. He just goes through stretches where he isn't as dominant as then he ends up being the next few starts. Like, it seems like that is just the pitcher he is, but is there anything more concerning than that with the way that Freddy has thrown the ball lately?
No, I don't think so. I just think it's kind of the natural ups and downs of the season. Any pitcher, even the great ones, are going to go through spells where, you know, they're struggling with their command, struggling with whatever, just not feeling good. You know, one of their good pitches is not working as well as they wanted to. I thought it was interesting. You know, JR, you were at that game with me when last time Freddie pitched, and very early on, to me, it looked like, and I'm certainly no, you know, pitching coach or anything, but to me, it just looked like he was overthrowing and throwing, you know, like just trying too hard, if that makes sense. And he said after the game that he kind of was, because he was surprised at how good he felt. He had been dealing with that groin issue for a while, and the groin issue now is, it sounds like it's pretty much back to normal and gone, and he's feeling great. And, you know, was overthrowing essentially as a result of that. So I would expect that'll get dialed in, and you know, Freddie will get back to the, you know, the typical six innings and, you know, quality start type stuff every time out that we're used to seeing. He's too good to not get back to that. And I think it's just kind of a blip on the radar screen.
Yeah, I think that's right. Similarly, like Bryce Turang had that injury, that shoulder injury. And I think it sort of explained why we weren't seeing that top shelf defense earlier in the year. And we've seen more of that this week. Joey Ortiz has had a great defensive week this week. The Brewers really do look like the 2024 team, where the defense makes plays. Jackson Churio made a nice sliding catch in center field in Philadelphia. The defense makes plays, and the pitchers are fine. They're not special, but they're fine. And the defense behind them does the work. And I mean, even if Freddy Peralta doesn't have his best stuff, they come back, they win that game. He keeps it close, and they come back and they win that game. One last thing before we get up to the three up, three down. I thought Sunday made me laugh, because we talked last week about how Pat Murphy loves his like leverage bullpen arms above all else. Nick Mears, Jared Koenig, Abner Uribe, Trevor Megilla. Those are the four. Those are the buttons that he wants to push. And this team was tired. The relievers were tired. I think this week they were able, and winning will help with this, were able to kind of even out some of the workload, and were able to get those guys some rest, much needed rest. Nick Mears went several days before appearing again on Sunday. But this is the Pat Murphy game on Sunday. Jose Quintana starts, and then he goes to those four relievers, and they all look very good, and they all get outs, and they end up coming back to beat the Phillies. I bet Pat Murphy is having a great time on the trip to Cincinnati as we record this, because this was his ideal day, Todd.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think any manager, you know, they've got their favorites, and they've got the way that the bullpen lines up for them. And, you know, I go back to the old Craig Counsell days, the out-getter thing, but he was a master at that. And he had a specific way that he would line it up. Now, he'd never had fear, and he would utilize guys in different situations, but you knew when it came down to it, guys were rested, everybody was available, that he was going to go, you know, A, B, C, D. And generally speaking, that would work out well for him. So, you know, these guys certainly needed rest. They were running on fumes, and they got that rest that they needed. So good on the starters. And all things considered, they go into a Cincinnati series where I'm assuming they're going to be needed. And crazy things generally do happen at Great American Ballpark. So it's probably good news that they've got a relatively fresh bullpen available against the Reds.
That's right. Three games against Cincinnati, then they come back home, face San Diego over the weekend. That's what's ahead for the Milwaukee Brewers. All right, let's get into some of the more granular details from the week. Here it is, three up, three down. This is also the weekly part of the podcast where I remind everyone that what I've already failed to mention, and that's I have some interviews coming up afterwards. There's a couple, and they're very different. One is I talked to Abner Uribe, one of those relievers that we just mentioned. He's had a really nice year for the Brewers in some high leverage spots. So I talked to Abner Uribe on the last homestand. And then I have a conversation with Bob Nightingale of USA Today, our colleague in the Gannett sphere. And the conversation started with some pretty specific stuff. We talked about the Brewers in general as well, but specifically wanted to know about his thoughts on Mark Adonazio as a candidate for the commissioner of baseball. We've talked about that at the very beginning of the season as a possibility, and Mark has talked about it and kind of poo-pooed the idea. But he is, I think, one of the people that could be looked at that. We're several years away from Rob Manfred leaving his post, but he has said he's going to step down in a few years. So it's possible that Adonazio slides in there. So I talked specifically about that with Bob Nightingale. That is at the end of this conversation. But moving back to this week, Todd, I'm going to go back to the beginning on Monday. Kurt and I love this stuff. We love this, like, minutia when it comes to trades and when players face each other that have been traded for each other. That is what we got on Monday when Abraham Toro, now with the Boston Red Sox, stepped up to face off with Chad Patrick, who the two were traded for each other last year. The Brewers got, or 2 years ago now, Chad Patrick had a very nice year at Indianapolis last year. Toro was with Oakland, and they faced each other. Toro, of course, now with Boston, faced each other twice, and Patrick got them both times, grounded out in an RBI opportunity with a runner in scoring position, got him to ground out to end an inning, and then actually got him to strike out swinging on a ball that hit him. Abraham Toro was hit by the pitch, but ruled out because he swung at the pitch, very clearly swung at it. So point Patrick. Brewers won the trade, kind of, and always love it when those things come to pass, as they did on Monday. So that is my first one here on 3 Up, 3 Down.
How about Jackson Churio ambushing Garrett Crochet to kick off that series against the Red Sox? That's a fun moment. I think everybody's kind of, I wouldn't say scratching their heads about Jackson Churio's sophomore season here, because, again, he is still young, still lacking experience overall. But to see him start to swing the bat well, again, obviously bodes well for this offense and bodes well for the Brewers. So we'll see if he gets back on track. And a fun little fact that I discovered while kind of digging through some numbers and some stats and everything. JR, were you aware that Garrett Crochet was one-time draft pick of the Brewers?
I did know that. Him and Carlos Rodon are two guys that I tend to keep just a little bit of an extra eye on, because I know that the Brewers were once upon a time trying to get those guys.
Yeah, 34th round in 2017, ultimately chose to sign with the University of Tennessee, and obviously that worked out well because he got drafted 11th overall in the 2020 draft and has parlayed that into a mega contract.
Yes, that very much worked for him. I actually was watching Chris Lavonis at Wake Forest, the player that the Brewers drafted, really tried to sign him over slot this year, was unsuccessful. Lavonis was very dedicated to going to Wake Forest, so he was pitching in the College World Series, not the World Series, but the regionals, the tournament. Did not actually fare very well, but yeah, I keep an eye on those guys. Yes, it certainly was the right call for Garrett Crochet. There's no way anyone could have seen, at least on the Brewers side, what was going to come, I would imagine. And Crochet worked out. Carlos Rodon, it worked out. Not so much for the Brewers, but there are other guys that they've also drafted that that teams had first crack at when they were coming out of high school. My number two, Quinn Priester is interesting to me. He had just a really amazing outing on Friday night. He was not the guy who started the game. There was the opener, D.L. Hall, threw three excellent innings, and then Quinn Priester came in and worked the final six innings. He got 16 of his 18 outs on ground balls. He had no walks and no strikeouts. Modern pitching that never happens. And I don't know what to make of Priester. I think like I've said earlier, if there is one, I would say, you know, weakness in the starting rotation, it's his spot, because, you know, he's still, I imagine the Brewers haven't had a chance to really, like, work with him as much as they would if they had gotten him in the offseason. So, you know, the pitching lab, so to speak, hasn't been able to really work on him yet. And he's holding his own. I still think they could probably do better, but they seem pretty dedicated to keeping him on the big league roster. They don't want to use that last option year and sort of preserve flexibility with him going forward. They have him for many years under team control, and they seem pretty dedicated to making it work. And that was a really impressive performance. So they can't send him down yet. You know, like he seems to be finding himself a little bit, but I don't know what to make of him. They've got all these pitchers coming out of their ears right now, and I would assume Priester is the guy who's going to end up at AAA at some point, but I shouldn't assume that because I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, I mean, the guy's still 24 years old. It's hard to wrap your head around, but he, you know, high school kid, 2019 draft, 18th overall pick. There's a lot to like here, and I think it's a guy that's just continuing to develop and to learn the game. And as we all have seen over the course of X number of years now, once Chris Hook and Jim Henderson have their way with a guy, they tend to get the best out of him. And I think you're starting to see glimpses of that. I was just, while you were talking, I called up Priester's profile on Savant here, and it's very interesting. After the heavy ground ball outing the other day against the Phillies, he's now in the 94th percentile in the majors with a 58.1% ground ball percentage. So good for him. Opponents are only barreling him up 6.3% of the time. That's 73rd percentile, which is pretty good. But the rest of his profile, all blue, which is not good. So yeah. still has some work to do. But overall, I think that there's stuff to like. There's stuff to be excited about. But this is a guy that in a move that Brewers fans, I know, are going to be very critical of moving forward just based on what they gave up to get him, you know? So obviously the expectations are going to be probably extraordinarily high when it comes to Quinn Priester, right or wrong, fair, unfair. That's just the way it's going to be. So
for sure. All right. What's your number two?
Well, again, in my run of bad luck, if you want to call it that, why am I not covering any of the fun games? You know, I'm not working on Tuesday, and then Yelly hits the walk-off grand slam, and I was watching at home, and I see him swing the bat, and I'm like, of course I'm not working this game. You know, I get stuck with all the bad ones, but we all know that's not how it works. But just what a moment, you know, what a moment for him, what a moment for the Brewers. You know, you and I talked about just I think at the game on Wednesday about what a weird team the Red Sox are, all that talent and just playing horribly. The AL East, really, if you look at that division, it's crazy, aside from the Yankees, how bad that whole division has been. But, you know, good for Yelly. And as we talked about earlier in this podcast, it's nice to see him swinging the bat well and consistently and being the run producer that the Brewers need for him to be. Now we'll wait and see and, you know, kind of keep an eye on whether or not that hand is going to sideline him for any amount of time.
Yeah, let's see. What's my number three? You know what? To go back to yours before I do that, first of all, what I loved about that game was he doubles off of Aroldis Chapman, who is obviously one of the premier left-handed relievers of the past decade or more. And that was his first extra base hit against the lefty all season long. That's in the ninth inning. Yelich then ties that game. It was 1-0. The Brewers were going to lose 1-0. And Yelich doubles for his first extra base hit off a lefty all season, down the line, scores the run to tie the game and send it to extras. And then he gets to come up in the spot with the bases loaded. This is against a righty, against Liam Hendricks this time, and parks a home run. Then he ends up homering off of a lefty in Philadelphia. So, like, something got unlocked there. But, you know, he had been miserable against lefties this year. And it is still a small sample when you're talking about handedness stats just 2 months into a season. But it was like a 167 batting average, 8 singles. It was really bad. And so I would not have dreamed that he would have come through the way he did against Aroldis Chapman, other than, you know, Christian Yelich still has quite a bit of track record back there. So that was impressive. And then, of course, they go on to win the game in very electric fashion. Reminds everyone, of course, of Dan Vogelbach, his walk-off grand slam in 2021 when they were down 3 and ended up winning by one run because of the slam against the Cardinals. That was pretty cool. All right, my number three, what do I have? You know, Sal Frelick did something that was really impressive that is sort of part and parcel of just what his defense brings to the table is he threw a guy out. Marcelo Mayer of the Boston Red Sox was trying to go first to third on a single, and Sal Frelick threw a cannon to throw him out. That out became very valuable in a pretty low, in a tight game early in the week. And then I think it came up again on Wednesday. Sal Frelick, there's a single to Sal Frelick, runners coming around second, and they end up holding him. Because I think it's because they had just seen Sal Frelick throw a guy out, you know, rather than try to send the runner to the plate, they held him. And Willier Abreu completely missed that memo. He's running from, he's thinking he's going first to third. He ends up running into a wall, coming all the way to third base where the runner's been held. The Brewers end up getting a free out of the deal because the Red Sox had two runners at third base. Now, the Red Sox did end up scoring two runs in that inning to go up 3-1 in that game on Wednesday. So it wasn't like that saved a run per se, but I think it's just naturally going to get into people's heads. They just saw Sal Frelick throw a guy out. They're going to be extra cautious and end up burning Boston in that particular moment. But he looks like a Gold Glover again. You know, I was surprised that he won the Gold Glove last year in right field. I honestly hadn't thought about it. Even when he was one of the finalists, I didn't think it would go to him per se, but then, you know, he wins and he's got a reputation and it is well-deserved. He is a tremendous defensive player. And you know, he's gotten a lot of, I think, good luck this year offensively. He's hitting a lot of singles, but even without making solid contact, he's having a really good year. And I started to feel like he's kind of like one of the leaders on this team, right? Or like, I don't know about the leader on this team, but he's like one of the faces of this team. That kind of snuck up on me, Todd. I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been joking with people for the last couple of weeks about if Pat Murphy could design a team or manage a team made up of all Sal Frelicks and Caleb Durbins, I think he would embrace that and love it. You know, and these are Pat Murphy kind of guys who are not, you know, they don't have the physical measurables, but just somehow get the job done and are gritty and gutty and everything. But beyond all that, I mean, Sal Frelick is a really good player and good guy. You know, Kurt wrote a good story today and Sunday, going into Monday, about his work with a charitable organization too that everybody should check out. So just a tremendous asset to the organization on the field and off the field, a great guy and good for him. You know, this is, and there's more to come too. You know, he's still a young guy. So it's been fun to kind of watch him develop, and it makes you wonder how good he will be able to be, you know, moving forward in his career.
All right, what's your number three? Close this down.
Looking at your notes here, I think Rob Zastrzyzny, Rob Z, as Murph likes to call him. I love this guy's story, and so much so that I had a really nice interview with him last week. I'm going to be doing the off day story on him, a little sneak peek, a little teaser for this coming week. Had a really good chat with him, and this is a guy that's been with eight or nine major league organizations in his career. And that being said, his service time is a little over 1 year in the big leagues. He's bounced around that much. And, you know, he had success in a small stint last year, hurt his elbow and was never to be seen again. Was cut loose, signed with the Cubs in the off season. They cut him loose. He went to the Yankees. Yankees wound up with his upward mobility. They wound up sending him to the Brewers for some money. And he's right back where he was happiest last year. And he told me a kind of a fun story after he had been cut loose by the Yankees because of this upward mobility. He was driving in the car with his wife, and his wife turned to him and asked him, she said, "Honey, if you had your choice, you know, all things being equal, what organization would you like to wind up with next?" And he said, "I'd like to be with an organization that knows me and that I'm comfortable with and that I did good things with. So probably the Brewers." And then later that night, he gets the call that he's going to the Brewers. So destiny, right? And, you know, just kind of in the few outings that he's had since he's been back with the team, he's been good. He's already opened, which is a role that he did okay in last year as well. So just one of those stories of perseverance and obviously, the pitching is the most important thing, and he's done well whenever he's taken the mound for the Brewers. So it's a guy you can kind of root for, and there's more good stuff to come here in my story, which will be running on Thursday.
Couple things we did not talk about in three up, three down. Joey Ortiz had an amazing play on Sunday. One of those plays that I remember when I was trying to watch like a highlight reel of him when the Brewers traded for him. Like he had a couple with Baltimore that were really special. This was one of those, and he able to turn that into an out. His defense has been electric, even as his offense has floundered. There was also a kind of a subterranean moment Monday when Andrew Montecerio hit a ball that ended up being an RBI double. It was foul down the third baseline, but kicked fair over the third base bag. So it was fair, and the umpire was right on top of it. As somebody who has seen a lot of youth baseball this season, have a children of age, youth baseball and softball, just a good thing to note that just because it's foul now, until you touch it, it is fair. If it goes back, if it hooks back over that third baseline, over that third base bag, that is a fair ball. So I found that funny. Tried to use it as a teaching moment, as if my kids listen to me when I start talking about baseball rules. They have no interest whatsoever. It's got to come from the coach, or they're never going to listen. So, all right, let's go back in time here. Something that Todd, I'm curious if you know from your youth. It is our edition, our weekly segment, Remember When. Todd, were you following the Brewers in 1980? Is that too far back?
I was 9 years old or so?
Yep.
Yeah, nine years old. So, I mean, I knew the players on the team, but was not like a hardcore fan yet, if that makes sense.
I was looking up, trying to come up with a remember when for the week, very early in the week before the Brewers had hit walk-offs against Boston. And I was trying to look up some of those moments, Joey Meyer hitting a walk-off homer against Roger Clemens when Clemens was in his prime.
I was there. I was in the stand.
Right down the right field line.
We couldn't believe it.
I'm going to save that one maybe for another day, because here's one that I figured I had talked about in the past and have not. And that's another walk-off grand slam against the Boston Red Sox on opening day in 1980. Sixto Lescano. I can't believe we haven't done this one before on Remember When. Sixto Lescano with a walk-off grand slam, just like Christian Yelich against the Boston Red Sox. This was before 53,000 fans in 43-degree weather in that first April day in 1980. The roof was open at County Stadium, Todd, on this day. But it was a 9-5 win. Very memorable. Most Brewers fans, I think, if you're talking about opening days, great opening days, there's two that come to mind. There's Lorenzo Cain making the catch against the Cardinals over the wall to save a homer and save the game. And then there is Sixto in the 1980 opening day. There were two outs in the ninth. It was his second home run of the day. The first one came against Hall of Famer Dennis Eckersley, known for his relief pitching, but was a starter, of course, with Boston for a long time. The second one, the winner, comes against Dick Drago, the big winner, opposite field shot. Boston had tied the game in the ninth on solo homers from Carl Yastrzemski, 40-year-old Carl Yastrzemski, still there. He'd gone 3-for-4 on the day. Butch Hobson had also homered, so that tied the game. The Brewers hit a ton of homers on the day. You had Ben Ogilvie, Paul Molitor, Don Money. They'd all homered, and Sixto had homered once before when he came to bat in the ninth. I think we kind of forget how good Lescano was in 1979. 78, 79, those are two very good Brewers seasons, the first two good Brewers seasons. And Lescano was incredible in 79. He won a gold glove, first of all. He was excellent offensively. He had a 987 OPS. He drove in 100 runs. He had a 414 on base percentage. Love that Milwaukee-themed number. 414 on base percentage. 164 OPS plus. I mean, he was a dude. That was by far his best season. And then he carries that over into the 1980 opener. It was Buck Rogers managing, first game for Buck Rogers at the helm. George Bamberger, who had been manager, had open heart surgery. So Bamberger was on the sidelines. He was not available, and Buck Rogers took over for him. Lescano dedicated the game to Bamberger afterwards. It was the debut of the new scoreboard. I think we all think of that clunky, you know, graphic sort of scoreboard that the County Stadium had with those like black and white graphics. That's not what it is, but sepia, I guess. Is that what we'd call those graphics?
Yeah, but this was like, they're almost just like regular light bulbs, I think, you know, like
that's right. Like, yeah, it, very weird. But this was the debut of that scoreboard. So this is the first time fans can see instant replay in the stadium in Milwaukee. So they got to see Sixto Lescano homer a couple times, you know, in sepia toned light bulb, but still they got to see it. So I thought that was kind of cool. A couple notes. People were upset handing out leaflets because they were serving hams, the Minnesota beer product hams, at the game. And people were not happy about that. They felt all the beer should be from Wisconsin. There were local breweries worried about this and handing out leaflets. And also Sixto Lescano's first First game back in 1974, hit a walk-off single, but that was his major league debut. He's the only Brewers player to hit a walk-off in his major league debut. And then, of course, he has this nice opening day 6 years later. All right, that'll do it.
So, not to cut you off there, but I was just kind of looking at his bio while you were talking, and I think most Brewers fans know that he was part of the package that went to the Cardinals in exchange for Raleigh Fingers, Ted Simmons, and Pete Vukovich in 1980.
That's right.
Yep. Pretty incredible
later that year.
There. Yeah, and then the next year, which I didn't realize looking at this now, he was traded by the Cardinals to the Padres along with Gary Templeton for Ozzie Smith.
How about that? So yeah. So in a year's time, Sixto is traded for, what is it, four Hall of Famers? Because it's Ted Simmons, Raleigh Fingers, and Pete Vukovich who come back to the Brewers in that massive blockbuster that Whitey Herzog of the Cardinals swings in the winter meetings of 1980. Obviously, all three of those guys are very important. In fact, Ted Simmons, by the way, once had back-to-back Red Sox, back-to-back walk-off hits against the Red Sox on his own in 1983, back-to-back games, and he was author of both. But obviously, future Hall of Famer Ted Simmons, and then he gets traded for Ozzie Smith. The man was just—he was the currency for Hall of Famers, Sixto Lizcano.
And
very popular here. People loved him here. He was Bob Betts, the press box guy, would do the very famous Sixto Lizcano. I did that extremely poorly. Do not interpret that as any sort of mimicry, but he was very famous, very popular, fun player.
Sixto also, he had his second best year after that trade to the Padres in 82, hit .289, 16 homers, 84 RBI, 860 OPS. And he went on to play up to 1985, played for the Phillies and then finished out with 72 games with the Pirates. So good career for him.
Yeah, if he had not been traded, he probably would have been on that Cardinals team that faced the Brewers in the World Series. There were a couple guys who were in that deal who ended up, you know, facing the Brewers. So that was an interesting couple of roster moves there. All right, let's close this down the way we do every week. And it is with Todd's Take of the Week. Here it is. Bring it to us, Todd.
Ten-game homestand coming up after these three in Cincinnati, and to me, this is going to be a real big barometer as to whether the Brewers are real or not. You know, obviously, it still remains to be seen what happens in Cincinnati. Anything can happen, and usually does there at that ballpark. The Reds' pitching is obviously really good; offense, not so much. But off day on Thursday, the 5th, and then three at home against the Padres, followed by three at home against the Braves, followed by four against the St. Louis Cardinals. All these teams are talented. Cardinals are playing really well, have been playing really well. So we'll see what happens. You know, the Brewers, to me, if they are for real, they've got to have a winning homestand at least and, you know, show that they can punch with some of the big boys. And then after that, it's another road trip starting with three at Wrigley Field, the first trip down to Wrigley Field for the Brewers this year. So I believe this is the longest homestand of the season for the Brewers as well. I could be off on that, but I'm pretty sure. So weather should be nice. I would expect a lot of open roof games. Should be good times had by everybody all around.
How many games in Cincinnati do they have to win before you, Todd Rosiak, start thinking about George Webb's burgers now that they've won seven in a row? Is it the eighth one? Is it the ninth one?
I think they got a sweep.
Well, I mean, they do, but so you're not even thinking about it until they get to 10, though. That's the mark where it starts to get serious.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen too many games in Cincinnati, covered too many games in Cincinnati to know that the likelihood of them coming out of it with a 6-0 road trip, coming home with George Webb's on the line, highly, highly unlikely, as Gorilla Monsoon would say.
That's probably true. I'm already thinking about it. Maybe we'll write about it this week. Who knows? If they win one in Cincinnati, I might bust out some of that old George Webb content. We might have to write about that at jsonline.com. He is Todd Rosiak. Find everything he has at jsonline.com. He'll be in Cincinnati covering the Milwaukee Brewers, and we'll see if this win streak can keep going. And again, after the Reds, the Padres at home, kicking off a three-series homestand, like Todd said, the longest of the year. So we'll see if the Brewers can get comfortable. Todd, thank you for joining me this week.
JR, always a pleasure.
I agree with you. It is. I am a pleasure. Let's get to my interview. Two interviews, actually. We've got Abner Uribe, who was gracious enough to sit down with me here in this last homestand. So chatted with him a little bit. He's having a very good year for the Brewers. And then we had my conversation with Bob Nightingale of the USA Today, talking primarily about Mark Adonazio and his sort of candidacy, if we could call it that, for the commissioner's position when that gets open here in a few years. We also talked about possible labor stoppage, just some big picture stuff, including who the Brewers could maybe go after if they would tweak this roster. My conversation with him was a couple weeks ago, so it's not really dated, but maybe you could keep that in mind. All right, thanks for listening to this edition of Microbrew. We'll chat with you again very soon. Bye-bye. My guest is Abner Uribe, reliever for the Milwaukee Brewers. And Abner, wanted to start with kind of the beginning of your career with the Brewers. How did they find you when they signed you? Were you already throwing as hard as you are now? Like, what kind of player were you back then in the beginning?
I was in the year 2018, so I was doing like a lot of tryout. But when they were found me, I was staying in the Cardinal San Luis Academy for like 2 days. Mm-hmm. And then I came out to go to the Milwaukee Complex, but I do like 5 tryout, and I do not throw that hard that I'm throwing right now. I was throwing like 82, 83.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then like after a year, like that's when they signed me, but I was throwing like 88, 87.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
What did you do to get up to 100?
Just working a lot back home, you know. And then 2019, yeah, I played 2018. It was like good. And at the end of the 2018, I get hurt on my knee. So I came out to Arizona in 2019. And I work a lot on the gym, like during the gym, the whole year, the whole process. And then after the whole process, I start throwing 98, 97.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, like a couple times. And that's how I throw hard.
How was 2020 for you? Did that derail you? Did that help you to have COVID and everything?
I mean, I think it helped me because I went back to, I was in the AC complex, but when COVID happened, I went back to the yard and I started working with my brother and my friend back there. Yeah.
Okay.
Kobe wasn't that good, like, for anybody, but
right, that's
helped
true.
Me, I like, a little bit for working, you know.
Yeah. Excellent. Were you a good hitter, too, growing up?
Yeah.
Yeah? But pitching was the thing you wanted to do?
My mama told me about that.
Your mom told you should go into pitching. That's great. I want to know about your celebrations on the mound. Like, if that's something that you've always done, is that something you think about and plan in advance, or is that just comes up naturally?
I started doing that at 21 during the season because I'm always getting emotional. I'm emotional people, like,
sure,
when I'm in the mouth. But, yeah, I started doing that in 21. I have a couple crazy videos.
Do you have a couple that you haven't revealed yet that are still to come?
Yeah.
You're ready.
It's crazy.
That's cool. How would you describe last year? You had the weird injury, the hacky sack thing. There's the Jose Siri thing. As you look back at 2024, what comes to mind? How do you think about that year?
I mean, like, what happened last year, I mean, como se dice, no tuvo que pasar, pasó, pero no tuvo que pasar, pero.
Whatever happened last year have to happen, mm-hmm, so he can learn from that.
Yeah, exactly. So I learned a lot. So I work a lot last year. I live in, like, in the gym, so.
Yeah.
My goal last year is just prepare my mind to compete, and my body left in a lot, so that's what I'm doing right now. So the work that I do last year paid me off right now, so.
Yeah.
And I'm still working. I got to still work until they still pay me off, so, yeah.
I want to hear the story about how you learned English. My understanding is, like, just music, right?
Yeah, so I learned English, like, couple years ago, but I have, like, afraid to speak English. But last year, like, during whole process of my surgery, so I gotta speak it.
All right.
I gotta speak it.
And who were some of the artists that you listened to that helped them?
I like Lil Baby a lot. I've been listening to Lil Baby, like, most of the time. But after that, I go, like, with some slow music, like Giveon, so that, okay, I can understand the whole world. So, like, more than Lil Baby.
Yeah.
Because Lil Baby too fast.
There's a lot of words.
So, and then I go back to Giveon, and then I take it slow, and that's when I learn.
Awesome.
As a relief pitcher, saves. Are saves important to you? Is that a statistic that you really care about? It's not necessarily your role right now, but.
I mean, like a reliever pitcher, like that's the goal. Like for every reliever, yeah. Being a closer. But right now, it's not on my job right now. So, my job is like throwing my whenever any they give him to prepare for the closer, and he do the job. So, that's what I'm doing right now.
I ask this of a lot of people. What are you into besides baseball? You said the gym a lot, and I'm sure that's part of it too. But like, what do you do in the off season? What are the things that you are passionate about?
Spend time with my family back home. You know, season like 6 months, you're here in USA, so I have no time to spend too much in DR. So when I'm back there, I just want to spend time with family.
Sure. Last question. What is left for you? What do you still want to work on as a player? Like, what do you still want to get better at?
I think I guess I need to work like my emotion, like, and my mentality on the mound. Then I get like super excited too much, like, cause that's gonna help me a lot at the end of the day. So yeah.
But your emotion probably helps you too, don't you think?
Yeah, but sometimes I go over on it, you know.
Sure.
So yeah.
All right, Abner Uribe, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
My guest is Bob Nightingale, baseball columnist for USA Today. He covers, covers Major League Baseball from a national perspective, and thought if we were talking about Mark Adonasio and the possibility of him becoming commissioner down the line here when Rob Manfred is done, he would be the guy who knows. And that's exactly where I want to start, and how viable you think Mark Adonasio is as a candidate for that position. He kind of played it off before the season as, you know, so he was, of course, he didn't reveal, you know, strictly one way or the other, but he played it off as not really something he's super interested in or super involved with. I get the sense there isn't really a specific pool of people that are being chosen from at this point, that are being, you know, zeroed in on. How do you view it? I know we're a couple years away from that, but where do you see him in this process?
Yeah, certainly among a top pool of candidates. I think baseball wants to have a former owner or at least someone involved in the front office in the position. They love the fact when Bud Selig was there, you know, from 92 to 2015, they kind of like to have an owner, even, you know, obviously would have to divest his interest in the Brewers, but very well thought of, you know, lives in LA, lives in New York, but yeah, and it's been involved in a lot of labor things already and considered kind of in the inner circle of Rob Manfred's trusted guys.
Certainly the Selig example makes Milwaukee the perfect, you know, the perfect market. I wonder if there's sort of a agenda is the wrong word, but does it serve their interest to have somebody who has overseen a small market franchise like the Brewers, especially one that's had success like the Brewers? Do you think that's part of the calculus as well, or it's purely just here's a guy who's bi-coastal who's been involved in some of this stuff already?
No, I think the success they've had, success as a small market team, being the playoffs as frequently as they have, success the Brewers have had without ever being in the top payrolls. And no, they like his acumen and everything else. So no, you just well thought of. I mean, he could live anywhere, but I think they like the fact that he's a small market guy, is going to represent the small and mid-sized market interests that are just having a guy who used to be a large market owner.
What do you think the next step in the process will be? Like, will we find out this time next year, maybe some of the names that are really being sort of vetted for this post, or are we still, you know, I guess what do you see as like the next step?
I mean, we could be 2 years away. Yeah. You know, things will, you know, they'll finally get a pool together and say, okay, who's a real viable candidate, who isn't. Should be, you know, several club presidents like Sam Kennedy of Boston would be interested.
Yeah.
Derek Hall, there's on Diamondbacks, have expressed lots of interest before. And of course, the people right there in the MLB office too, like a Morgan Sword, a Noah Garden, you know, that sort of thing. So yeah, it's still too early to say, okay, who's the favorite. But I think in the next couple of years, we'll say, okay, who was the leading candidates?
When Bud Selig sort of became commissioner, I don't quite remember the timeline, if it was when he became interim commissioner or exactly, you know, when he was promoted to the full-time post, when he divested his share to his daughter, Wendy Selig Preeb. I don't know what the process entails. And I don't know if it's even clear to the general public, like when, if Mark Adonasio is in a position where he has to divest his team, can he do that just to his sons, which he has said he wants to keep it in the family? Can he just do that, or would he have to, you know, is that still a too strong of a conflict of interest? I don't know how Major League Baseball looks at this stuff.
No, I think as long as you divest and goes to the family, that's fine. It was fine in the Bud Selig case. And I don't think they'd have a problem with that. I mean, it's up to the other 29 owners, but I can't see them saying, you know what, we have a big problem. It's not like, you know, Mark Antanasio is going to have every single decision directed toward the Brewers' way. So, yeah. You know, they trust him enough to know that.
How do you view him, or do you think the national perspective views Mark Antanasio as an owner? I think every ownership group gets some flack from the local team. Everyone's always like, you could always spend a little bit more. There are plenty, I think, examples out there of worse situations. Adonazio, not one of the, by any means, one of the richest owners in the game, but the team that he oversees has been competitive compared to market size, certainly. What do you think the national perspective is on him?
Yeah, I think very well thought of. The fact that, you know, hey, it's the smallest market in baseball. They win. There's been no complaints from other owners. Think, okay, the money they make, they put it right back in the team, not like some other markets. So that they're doing the best they can with the resources they have. And, you know, you only hear them complaining, that sort of thing, just, you know, going back and doing business. So it's almost like you're talking about model franchises. It's always been the Milwaukee Brewers and the National League, Tampa Bay Rays, and in the American League. And obviously, you know, they've done things right. Even when they wanted stadium improvements, you know, boom, they get the over $500 million done. When teams like, you know, the Tampa Bay Rays can't get anything done, the Diamondbacks are fighting with the state. So obviously very good, you know, with politicians as well.
Before I'll ask you a little bit about the Brewers in 2025, your thoughts on this particular team. But before Adonazio or anyone takes over for Rob Manfred, there is the looming threat of a work stoppage. And I don't know if it's quite time to like sound the alarm bells on that, but it's looking like it's going to be a really difficult thing to get through the next, this would be after the 2026 season, to get, to get past that smoothly. What is your perspective on sort of the issues at hand there? And how certain would you feel right now that there is going to be a work stoppage to solve this thing?
Yeah, we're still 2 years away, but right now when you talk to, you know, people from the baseball union, people from the owners, they think it's a very high probability, you know, probably over 75-80%, there's going to be a work stoppage. Kind of reminds you back in 94 and 95, you know, hopefully the work stoppage or lockout, you know, doesn't go that long. But I think the two sides will be already fighting as far as, okay, we need a luxury tax. I mean, we need a salary cap. We need a salary floor. We need to change the model to make sure everybody it can be competitive. And right now, there's just too many teams that aren't really trying to win and kind of giving up before the season starts, which isn't fair, of course, to the fan bases.
So, okay, the 2025 Brewers. Again, you have people clamoring. They should have spent more. They did very little this offseason. But and I do think that has come to roost to some degree in the early part of the season. But they do have this track record. And even with a slow start, you have to acknowledge they found a way. They found ways, even without star power, without big free agent signings, they found a way to stay competitive. How do you, from what you know of the 2025 team, what strikes you this early in the season? And what would, I kind of am curious if you think of them as a, you know, perennial playoff team, or they just kind of need all the breaks to go their way. And that has happened, maybe not so much yet this season. How would you view them?
Yeah. I mean, they've always kind of been exceeded expectations, you know, even going back to last, 10 years really. And they, they didn't spend much money at all in the off season. You know, they made the good movement getting Quintana for a cheap $4 million. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of injuries at starting rotation. You know, Woodruff now hurt again with the leg injury, losing Adames. Trading away Evan Williams, you can't trade away an elite closer like that and expect not to have some groin pains. And they've had that. You know, they blew the game in Arizona a few weeks ago, blown a couple others. So I think this is kind of I'm not saying rebuilding year, but it's a tough year for them to compete with the Cubs and even the Reds for that matter. And they're holding their own. The division hasn't slipped away from them, but I think a lot has got to start going right because it's such a young team.
Yeah, and the Cardinals are in the mix too. I really think the Cubs are the cream of the crop in the NL Central. The Cardinals are sneaky right now, but I don't know if I think any team is really going to challenge Chicago. I don't know if you see it differently, or if you think maybe the Reds or the Cardinals have what it takes to contend with the Cubs or the Brewers for that matter. But I don't know. I don't know if you see it like I do. Chicago seems like the cream of the crop there.
Yeah, you know, they're a good, solid team. Playing better than I thought they would. You know, if they had Bregman, it would have been, hey, lights out. They get Alex Bregman. I thought the Reds would be better. They're having more growing pains than I thought. A lot of blown games late. So St. Louis, I can't see it lasting. I mean, they're supposed to rebuild this year. This kind of goes against their plans. It's almost like, the movie Major League, where the ownership wants to start losing so they can trade away players at the deadline. And right now, if they stay in contention, they can't do that because the fan base would go ballistic. So, but I do expect the Cardinals to fade at some point and for the Reds to pick it up. And the Brewers should be in the picture too, at least a wild card picture, come September.
All right, last one. As we look at this Brewers team, it's pretty easy to see that they need some offense at this point. They have in the past. We saw with Willy Adames back in 2021. They're willing to make trades in May if they have to address what they've done. They've already traded for Quinn Priester this year to bolster their rotation. Is there someone out there that you think could be available early in the season? The Rockies are in a bad place, but they've very, historically reticent to trade players. I don't know if the White Sox exactly are doing, or if they have players that could bolster a team like Milwaukee. Are there any names, any deals out there that strike you that could potentially boost what Milwaukee is doing here in 2025?
I don't think guys that would help Milwaukee. I mean, Ryan McMahon's available, the infielder for the Rockies.
Yeah.
I see the Brewers trading for him. They're not going to trade for Luis Robert, the White Sox. He's making $15 million this year with $20 million options. So I don't see that guy. I really don't. They're not trained for Nolan Arenado. So I think they go with what they have. I think a lot of eyes will be on the Brewers the next 2 months here, next 6 weeks, just to see what direction they go. Because if the Brewers aren't in the race, then all of a sudden you got guys like Freddy Peralta could be available. Certainly Reese Hoskins would be available, that sort of thing. So I think a lot of teams are looking at the other way, like, okay, if they fall out, we're going to pounce on the Brewers players run the other way around.
All right, Bob Nightingale, baseball columnist for USA Today. Thank you so much, sir. I really appreciate your time.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks, Aaron.